today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
You could make the argument that I'm being a hypocrite here by picking this song, because what's the arc of the song?
Right, right.
But I do have an argument to make for it.
All right, happy Friday, everyone. We have reached the conclusion of Story Song Week. That is today here on Rockin' the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan. Patrick Foster has been out this week, but with me is Steve Hawkinsmith. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Jim. How's it going?
We've been talking about story songs all this week. We've had listener picks. We've had Steve's picks. We're going to have Steve go last. He's going to be the anchor here, the headliner, I guess, the closing act, the whole thing, the whole shebang. It's going to end with Steve's last pick. I'll go first on this episode, but before we get to that, mention again, Steve, where people can buy your books. What are the books and where can people buy them?
Well, thank you so much for bringing this up, because of course now we're into the Christmas buying season.
That's right.
So yeah, if you're looking for things to add to the gift list, I hope you'll think about a mystery written by me for one of your loved ones who loves mysteries. The Homes on the Range series can be purchased. Well, the links are all available from my website, stevehawkinsmith.com, which is
important
amazing.
To mention.
I can't believe I got to Friday and never mentioned stevehawkinsmith.com. So if you go to the Homes on the Range page there, it'll shoot you out to the links to buy any of those. But you know, Amazon is a place you can go. You can find all those books and order them easily. Or there's a website called indiebound.com. If you want to go the indie route and support local bookstores, you can also order paperbacks of the books through there.
All right, great. So everybody do that. All right. That is
we'll wait a second. We'll pause. You please go.
Yeah, do that now.
Buy some books and then come on back. We'll be waiting.
Yes, do that now. In fact, if we can pause for a long time if you want to buy the book, read the book, and then come back to the show. You could do that as well.
Yeah, no, so. Amazon can probably get you the book by this evening.
That's
so
right.
I think we're gonna be hanging out here for about 24 hours to get the books have time to arrive, people to read them, go to bed. And when you're sipping your morning coffee tomorrow, Jim and I will still just be sitting here ready to talk about songs.
Now, let me ask you this question. I mentioned yesterday that you write books that are part of a series. Can the reader enter that series with any book, or do you need to start from the beginning with the series?
What a great question. I would say you can go either way with it. That
okay.
You can indeed jump in at any point. I make sure that to always explain the premise of the series at some point early on of like, you know, these guys were cowboys. One of them again, can't read, but he's brilliant. They found the Sherlock Holmes stories. They decided to give that a try. Now they're trying to be detectives. So like you'll get that explained to you again. And actually, that's all you really need to know in terms of backstory. You can really jump into any of them. And as long as you grasp that, you'll be able. Now, I will say also, like, their lives change as their
right.
circumstances change as the series goes along, and some of this things that they experience kind of change them or move them in this direction or that direction. So you're rewarded if you read it from beginning to end, you know,
right.
Start at book one and end at book seven. But you don't have to do it that way at all.
Each one is a self-contained story.
Each one is a self-contained story.
There's no like cliffhanger at the end. Of one.
Well,
it's not like Empire Strikes Back. It's not like that. You got to come back.
No, we don't get to a point where and the murderer is ... and then come back in 2 years and buy the next book.
No.
I would not do that to my beloved readers.
No, none of that. Okay. All right. So where are we here? Oh, yeah. I said I was going to make a story song pick.
Finally, we get to Jim.
Yes. I had one on Monday. I'll do one again now. Now this
but
one,
that was a week ago practically, man. I can't remember Monday.
Now this one is a band I know you like, Steve. I know you even brought them up when we were discussing this off mic. Power pop band with some really just tremendous lyrics. Not all the songs they do are story songs, but when they do a story song, it generally just really hits well. Just very vivid, good characters, good, you know, plot line, the arc, all the things that you think make for a great story song, often a twist at the end, right? And so this one I picked is the band Fountains of Wayne, and it is a song from 2007 called Someone to Love.
Shapiro got his law degree. He moved to Brooklyn from Schenectady, 93. Got some clients in the food industry. He says it's not the money, it's the recipes. He calls his mom, says he's doing fine. She's got somebody on the other line. Puts Coldplay on, pours a glass of wine. Curls up with a book about organized crime.
Okay, now, I want to hear your viewpoint on this song, Steve, but the thing I thought is really interesting about it and why I specifically chose it for this series is that it tells stories of two characters, and then at the end, the two characters come together, but not in the kind of... not in the cliched way, not in the way that you might expect the story would end. And that's what I really like about it. And I think as an author, right, that's something that you kind of always strive for, right, is how to avoid the standard, you know, the cliches of storytelling, right?
Yeah, you have to both give people what they want, but what they don't know they want. And you have to, it's a tricky balance that writers have to walk. Is, you know, of not thwarting people's expectations of the experience they're going to have, but subverting their expectations in a way that you can still surprise them. And that's absolutely what this song does, is it's setting up our expectation of where the song is going to go, where another band or songwriter might have taken this story. And they just take it a whole different way, but in a way that's not just sort of like cheap irony, I think, but it's also sort of just making a point about the way we live our lives.
That's
and
connection,
the connections we don't make as we go through our lives. And I'll just say, Fountains of Wayne, if one is looking for clever, clever lyrics that really use specific examples from life to build themselves out and build out characters and build out a world, that is them. That's something that they always did beautifully.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And I really admire the craftsmanship that goes into, there's like, you can tell real specificity and word choice on every line that makes you, that paints the exact picture they want in your mind. And again, these are very direct lyrics. Like, they're doing this on purpose. They want you to picture what they are describing. There's no, it's not REM kind of song where it can be about anything, right? And REM is one of my favorite bands. I'm not making fun of them. I'm just saying, by contrast, right? What the hell is that song about? We may never know. But this is a different kind of songwriting, and it's very specific and it's intentional. And I think sometimes there are people who maybe look down upon songwriters who use direct lyrics because they think that that's, you know, that that's less artistic in some way. But I think it is, when done well, absolutely to be admired.
Yeah, no, totally. Again, it's horrible that I cannot remember the name of the mega talented individual from Fountains of Wayne who we lost during the pandemic.
Adam Schlesinger.
Yeah. My God, what a talented guy. Because, you know, and this song perfectly illustrates it, is like, it's got hooks up the yin yang.
Yeah, just
like,
so yeah.
Musically is like banger. Wow. But you listen to the words and they are so incredibly clever. And he's dealing here with characters that we've seen, I think, in a lot of Fountains of Wayne songs. Like, one of the things that I really like about them is the specificity of the characters you get, and they do range. But there were a lot of songs, I think, that were sort of about or from the perspectives of young professionals.
Yes.
Yeah. And so, like, 20s or 30s person living in a city, working a job that's white collar but dead end. And sort of dealing with the ennui and angst of that. And that's absolutely what this song is. So he did it again. What a fantastic song. And I agree that in some folks' minds, I think there is a tendency to be dismissive of songs that are very direct. Like, I think about, you know, In the Middle of the Night, to revisit an earlier day in the week. You know, the Madness song, very direct lyrics about sort of a silly thing. And I think to some people that song would probably sound, they would think it was juvenile or like a novelty song, because it's funny and it's direct and it tells you a story. And I think it's also the reason why some people, some maybe rock and roll fans or you know, fans of rock pop of a certain stripe would be dismissive of country music. Right. Because it's speaking very directly, and it's speaking very directly from the experience of a certain segment of the American populace. And, you know, as a genre writer, I'll say I get into this is something that I've thought about a lot, because a lot of people are very dismissive of what I do. I write genre stories. I write, you know, mysteries and westerns and, you know, zombie stories. And, you know, stories that are designed to entertain, and stories where I can bring a lot of ideas to it, and I think, you know, artistic merit. But at the end of the day, I'm trying to connect with a reader and pull them in with my narrative and pull them all the way to the end and keep them entertained. And that's something that the sort of direct storytelling does. And it's very easy for literary minded people to be dismissive and look down their noses at that, and like, that can't be worth anything. There can't be any sort of, you know, artistic merit or integrity or craft to that, because you're just telling a story. You know, you're telling people the kind of story they want to hear. It's like, yeah, that's really hard to do, actually. It's very hard to do it well.
No, I can imagine. That's a really interesting perspective. I hadn't thought about that quite in your world. Now, I would say, from my perspective, you know, I do a different kind of writing in my career, but I would say I'm just amazed at what you do, because first off, you're, you know, it just seems to me like you're starting with this blank page that has endless possibilities, right? And when you work in journalism and nonfiction, you there's a box that you work within, mm-hmm. right? And different in fiction, I think. So I imagine you probably have to sort of create your own sort of boxes to keep you from just going off in any direction, right? So I'm sure there's certain techniques. We don't need to get into all that right now. But the thing that amazes me, and not just about writing fiction, but mystery in particular, is you're not just creating characters, dialogue, plot, all of that, but you're building like a puzzle. Mm-hmm. And that to me seems like infinitely more difficult. That's from my perspective.
Finally, someone takes their hat off to me.
Yes.
After all this week. No, thank you. But I'll say, like, it's true in the sense that it's extremely difficult to do. The mystery, a certain kind of mystery in particular, which is the kind of mystery I've mostly written, which would be called like a fair play puzzle mystery, like in the Agatha Christie style. Those are very hard to construct. I do it through, you know, as I believe we talked about earlier in the week, a ton of outlining and just thinking and brainstorming. And it, to combine that then with, once you have that sort of puzzle in place, then you have to build fun around it. I mean, there are some readers for whom the puzzle is the whole thing, and they all they want is to sort of like toy with the mechanism and see if they can see how it works. Most readers want that plus. I'm in fact a reader like that. I don't really respond to a mystery that's just all pure plot. And who was in the pantry with the candlestick at what time? There's got to be still fun characters there. There still has to be an interesting world there. There still has to be a whole story built around the story. And that takes a lot of work.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure of it. Okay, now, one more thing about getting back to the Fountains of Wayne song, Someone to Love. This may not surprise people, but I read that Adam Schlesinger said that he considered this sort of their Eleanor Rigby song in their catalog, right? And
yeah.
So I can totally see that, right? And in fact, so much so that in Eleanor Rigby, you have Father McKenzie, and in Someone to Love, you have a character named Beth McKenzie. So
there you go.
The connection is all right there.
Well, we'll leave it to him to tie it back to the Beatles, because obviously, you know, somebody who was a master of crafting pop hooks had to be a huge Beatles fan. And I thought about the Beatles when we were talking about this week and what songs were we going to do. And, you know, it's funny because we talked about sort of that bifurcation between appreciation for lyrics that are sort of direct and lyrics that are more poetic. And I would say the Beatles, you know, I'm not a rock historian, but I'd say they were pretty pivotal in a shift from old thinking about lyrics, where lyrics, everybody wrote very clear lyrics.
That's right.
Everybody's lyrics were very straightforward, to a much more poetic, impressionistic approach to lyrics. But the Beatles, even though they were, I think, key in making that transition happen, they also would write these songs that were very, very clear about who the characters were, what their world was, what were the details of that world. I looked at Eleanor Rigby, which of course is a classic, love that song, did not think it had quite enough of an arc to be a story song.
Right.
Also looked at She's Leaving Home as another example of just like a beautiful Beatles song that is putting you in the world of some characters. We're seeing them at a pivotal moment in their lives and something changes. And then what? And the ending is an ending where you sort of see that this isn't going to work out for her. This doesn't look good. She went off with the man from the motor trade. That doesn't sound too promising, but she had to do something. She had to go somewhere. But the ending is, I won't call it ambiguous, but it's not definitive.
Yeah, right.
And so that's why that one I couldn't quite say, oh yeah, let's put that one in the mix. But absolutely, the Beatles, I think, had all kinds of songs that had elements of the story song, or like Maxwell Silverhammer.
Well, sure.
I mean, yeah, like I thought about that. I'm like, well, what happens to Maxwell at the end? He does go on trial, and you do sort of get an ending in terms of what happens to the judge, but we don't get to see the ending. So didn't know if I could put that one in our little pantheon.
Right,
here.
Right.
But no, we had to mention the Beatles somewhere.
Can you explain Norwegian Wood? Can we go?
I cannot explain Norwegian.
No, but that shows you like the differences in the types of songs they would write, right? Because that obviously is very impressionistic, and you can, and you know, to the point where I think there's a certain segment of music listeners who might appreciate songs like that more because they can be studied. You know, they can be discussed. Mm-hmm. Everybody can have a different, you know, feeling about it or different interpretation, different, you know, approach to it. So anyway. So, speaking of Norwegian Wood, actually, I believe Lennon was inspired by Dylan, and here we have another Bob Dylan pick.
Hello, Jim and Patrick, Rockin' the Suburbs family. This is Marios Critiotis from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Wanted to get in on this story song prompt. This is really perfect timing. I was spending a lot of time, embarrassingly large amount of time, thinking about this and writing about this for my newsletter, which I'm not going to shamelessly plug here, because I'm a gentleman of class. But I was thinking about the role of the heist, because I'm such a sucker for a heist story. And of course, I'm a sucker for a story song. So I just started to think about the role of the presence of a heist in the medium of a song. And of course, there are examples. And it just so happened that my favorite story song is also a song about a heist. And that song is Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts by Columbia recording artist Bob Dylan. You might have heard of this guy. I certainly don't have any sort of unhealthy relationship with his music or words whatsoever. But I love, you know, I love this song in the context of kind of the lore behind Blood on the Tracks. One of, obviously, a masterpiece album, one of his best. But it's also fertile soil for the Dylan freakazoids to like overanalyze everything about it. You know, it's this extremely personal album where there's some trepidation over which demos, you know, should have been left on the cutting room floor, which ones should have made it onto the record. And then right smack dab in the middle of the final product is, and again, in the final product, there are these like deeply personal songs about heartache and loss, is a 9-minute story song about a heist. And it's just, it has all of the formula, the aforementioned kind of formulaic parts of a heist, you know, the setup, interesting characters, interesting setting. You know, it's like this 19th century small town, river town, where they had this kind of town festival. And while the festival is being concluded, they're kind of packing up the stuff. They're having one last show. You know, the cabaret is having this one last show. And the events that unfold during this show provide the cover for a bank robbery that occurs in the song. It's just such a great song. I love the melody. I think the melody gets a lot of flack because it's repetitive. But I think that's what makes the song, you know, it's a little Shakespearean. It's a little Homeric. It's really about the story. It's not about the melody. Even the demo, you know, he's got a New York demo of this song. It follows essentially the same format as the final product. The final product's a little more polished. There's like maybe a little more instrumentation on it, maybe a little faster. But he didn't really tweak it, which, you know, anybody who knows Dylan knows that means he was really kind of satisfied with the contents of the song. So yeah, perfect story, perfect heist, extremely satisfying ending with a little heartbreak, as always. You know, you can't rob a bank without a little collateral damage. But just love it so much, and just so excited to see what everybody else picks here, because this is such a cool topic. All right, later, guys.
Lily had two queens. She was hoping for a third to match her pair. Outside the streets were filling up. The window was open wide. A gentle breeze was blowing. You could feel it from inside. Lily called another bet and drew up the jack of hearts. Big Jim was no one's fool. He owned the town's only diamond mine. He made his usual entrance, looking so dandy and so fine.
Lily Rosemary and the Jack of Hearts. As Marios mentioned here, this is a heist story. And what is so interesting in this story, I think, is that Dylan tells you about the heist and you hear it mentioned at sort of different points, but there's like so much of the story is about the diversion or the other things going on so that the heist can be pulled off. Right. And then there was sort of, there's a twist at the end with one of the characters, and it's a very compelling, I think a very compelling story set out in a, you know, a bit of a non-traditional sort of structure.
Yeah, like the last time we talked about Dylan, we talked about, I think, how you're rewarded to sit down and read the lyrics, almost like a short story that you would read, as opposed to hearing it, even though it's a very entertaining song. It's really nice to listen to. I like it a lot. I found it, I had a hard time sort of like really following it point by point by point, because it's Bob Dylan. That's all cool. But when I had more clarity, you know, when I sat down and just read the lyrics, but, you know, hearing the song and what still came across, even though I couldn't quite follow all the time what was happening, was the vibe, and the imagery. And the swirl of the characters, and it did feel still very cinematic to me. Like he's telling this story with all this great imagery, and you could see it in your mind, almost playing out like a movie. And you know, to me, it really reminded me of sort of movies of that time where there was a revisionist trend in the Western, let's say. And I don't even know if this is, ever says it's set in the West.
No, but it sure seems like it. I mean, the hanging judge and all that stuff. Yeah.
No, actually, there's a festival and a cabaret. It's like, okay, maybe. But like, the Hanging Judge, that sure sounds like Western. And just like what the characters are doing feels like the kind of thing you would encounter in a Western. But at this time, late 60s, early 70s, you had this pushback against the traditional Western and, you know, sort of cinema, American movies as a whole were like really obsessed with the sort of the down and out, the losers, fringe characters, like Midnight Cowboy kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And this, to me, slots right in with that. It reminds me a lot of the Robert Altman movie, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, which is a Western. It is a Western, but it doesn't feel like a traditional Western. And it's more about these sort of offbeat characters, doomed characters within this world where there's crime and machinations and tragedy, all kind of playing out in this sort of wild setting.
Yeah, absolutely. Very well said. Okay. Steve, it's time now.
Have we reached the end?
It is. It is time for your last pick of the week for story songs.
Oh, boy. Well, Jim, now I'm going to be 100% serious. I'm going to be so serious. This is the song that I might have a hard time getting through. I'm already feeling it without getting a little choked up. This is a song that is The House That Jack Built by a singer-songwriter named Jessica Hoop that I don't know to what degree Jessica ever broke out. Not much, I think. I've been aware of her for quite a while and sort of, you know, followed her career from afar. I've never seen her live or anything like that. But she's just always struck me as interesting. Really an interesting songwriter. And a lot of her lyrics are of the sort of dense poetry sort that we've talked about. It's sort of like the other school. And they're really good lyrics, very evocative, but gosh, you might have to do some work to figure out what she's actually singing about. This is not that case. This is an autobiographical song that is pretty darn direct. And it is about dealing with the aftermath of the death of her father.
Right.
And I think anyone who has lost a parent, I can't imagine hearing this song and not relating to it and not feeling it. You know, unless somebody maybe had a very different relationship with their father. And I'm lucky, like, you know, my dad and I were close and we're very similar people and had a ton in common. And there's a, you know, so much of me is just carrying on who my father was. But here's a song from the perspective of someone who didn't have that,
right?
Who just could not relate to her father for reasons that you sort of come to understand a little bit from, but it's never explained a ton, but right. I don't think it has to be.
Right.
We get the idea. So she's coming back to Oklahoma, where her father has been dying, to get together with her family and go through his things and sort of divvy them up as one has to do in the aftermath of that. And feeling the sort of longing, the emptiness of doing that, because she didn't connect to him when he was alive, and all that's left now are his things and the stories about him.
Right.
And she's saying, that's not enough. I'm not feeling the connection. And I think you could make the argument that I'm being a hypocrite here by picking this song, because what's the arc of the song?
Right, right.
But I do have an argument to make for it. Towards the end of the song, obviously as songs will, there's sections that are repeated. And we get in the very last verse, you get a repeat of your deal was raw, but you loved us all. That's something we had heard early. So like the guy lived a hard life, but she felt the love, even though the connection on a sort of personal level was not there. But the last time she says it, she changes it just a little bit. And she says, your deal was raw, but you loved us, paw.
Mm-hmm.
And you feel that, you hear just a little pause in her voice, and she kind of goes up a little bit. And she says it almost with a question mark on it. And the way that I interpret that is, here's somebody who sort of went off into the world. And Jessica Hoop is someone who, like, she basically ran away from home when she was like 15 or something like that. And she went off and she lived her life in the world, places very far away from, Oklahoma or wherever, her dad might have been. But she's coming back and she's trying to connect with him, even though he's gone. And she feels the love, and she feels him as Pa, this sort of old fashioned way of addressing one's father that probably wouldn't come naturally to maybe someone like Jessica Hoop. But she's going to call him Pa. And I feel like in that one little moment, she communicates that there is the connection, or she's
interesting.
Something there that's a little different. Like, I've come back. I'm hearing these stories about you that I never knew before. I'm trying to connect that to myself and my understanding of you, Pa. And I don't know. To me, it feels like she got that little bit closer to relating to him as he would have wanted her to relate to him. And that to me feels like a conclusion.
I carried a bag of rock and stone full of memory of our family, or board a plane to Tulsa. 5 years of waiting for his life to end suddenly, tearing its way through me all of the way to Tulsa. It's not enough, it's not enough, it's not enough. It's not enough to know you through them. I walk through a door of a living room that I do not know, to a couch where he slept alone, in the boneyards of the house that Jack built. My brothers are sorting through his fine shoes and fine colognes, pictures of a childhood home, the glory of the house that Jack built. It's not enough, it's not enough, it's not enough. It's not enough to know you through them. Purple hearts and racing cars and the words for her you wrote. Your deal was raw, but you loved us all, and we know which note for note. Thank you.
It's a tremendous song. I mean, and I was not familiar with it. And I just listened to it for the first time last night. And it hits. It definitely hits, for sure.
You know, in its way, I just realized this as we were talking. It's a Cats in the Cradle song.
Yeah.
Which I hadn't made the connection, but like it absolutely is.
Yeah.
And it's just taking it from a different perspective, but it's telling sort of the same story of parents and children, and are they connecting when they have the opportunity right. to connect, and what's, you know, what do we have to deal with if we don't make that connection when we can, and does it leave us with a lifetime of regret? So yeah, they're both very much along that same path, just taking very sort of different ways of getting there. Although Cats in the Cradle is, you know, it fits our definition of a story song very nicely.
Oh, very much so, right?
Yeah, super direct and has an ending. Right. And is also, you know,
a twist, I would say, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. And but it comes to the thing of like, yeah, what do your kids even want from you? And so you're like, well, yeah, we're getting into some pretty deep water here.
Yeah. All right. So anyway, The House That Jack Built, Jessica Hoop.
Just jump in and say there are two versions of the song that are out there. It was originally recorded in 2012, and then during the pandemic, Jessica Hoop did an album where she revisited earlier songs, including this one. The album is called The Deconstruction of Jack's House, and it's a little more stripped down, and to me feels a little more personal and direct, and that's the version that I prefer. They're both great, but the you'll see that it's like the TDOJH version of The House That Jack Built is the one that I think is my preferred version. I think it really gets to the heart of the song, just that little extra bit more.
I will say one more thing here. getting to sort of metaphor, right, in use of metaphor and stuff. In the song, I think that literally she's talking about he built this house, mm-hmm. right? That's the impression you get as well. Like literally, he built this house we're in.
They're going to the house that Jack built.
Right. But also the house is like his world, right? That he lived in as well, you know?
Yes. And she's stepping into it
right.
both literally and figuratively.
That's right.
Absolutely yeah. correct. And sort of finding that the inside is not what she thought.
Right. Exactly. Okay. Steve, thank you very much for hanging out with me all this week.
Oh, Jim, thank you for both A, inviting me, and B, putting up with me. I really appreciate that you let me stick around and didn't kick me off Wednesday. This has been so much fun.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I checked the ratings midweek.
And I won't be back.
And they suggested to keep you on for the
at least through the end of the week.
Days. Yeah. But, you know, there was consideration, you know, once the numbers started coming in, the early numbers. Okay. Anyway, again, thanks very much. Everyone, go to stevehawkinsmith.com, and there you can get all the information about his various literary works.
It is your one-stop shop for all your Steve Hawkinsmith needs.
There you go. Sounds great. I guess that's about it. Thanks again to all the listeners who contributed to these episodes over this week. Patrick Foster should be back next week, I imagine. I'll track him down. We'll make that happen. It's Rock in the Suburbs. I'm Jim Lenihan.
And I have been Steve Hawkinsmith.
And thanks. We'll talk to you all later.
A child arrived just the other day. He came to the world in the usual way. But there were planes to catch and bills to pay. He learned to walk while I was away. And he was talking for I knew it. And as he grew, he'd say, I'm gonna be like you. Dad, you know I'm gonna be like you. And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon. Little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, Dad, I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then. My son turned 10 just the other day. He said, thanks for the ball, Dad, come on, let's play. Can you teach me to throw? I said, not today, I got a lot to do. He said, that's okay. And he walked away, but his smile never dimmed. Said, I'm gonna be like him. Yeah, you know I'm gonna be like him.
the cradle and the silver spoon. The little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, Dad, I don't know when, but we'll get together then. You know we'll have a good time then. Well, he came from college just the other day, so much like a man I just had to say. Son, I'm proud of you, can you sit for a while? He shook his head and he said with a smile, what I'd really like, Dad, is the bar of the car keys. See you later, can I have them, please? And the cat's in the cradle and the silver spoon. Little boy blue and the man on the moon. When you're coming home, son, I don't know.
I don't know where this is all headed, Steve, but thank you for letting me get it out, I guess.
Oh, yeah. No, it's been a great session. And I look forward to seeing you again.
And our time is up now.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.